For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome.
Good morning.
For new people, I'm Taigen Layton, the teacher here at Ancient Dragon Zengate, and I'm very happy to have given you a talk this morning, Asia Nancy Easton, who has been director of Intenso here, is now the teacher's assistant, and will be, starting April 1st, April 2nd, but beginning the practice period, for this practice period beginning April 1st for 2 months. For the 2 month practice period we have coming up, sharing the teaching with me. And she's going to be speaking this morning, and recently came back from a few weeks practicing in Kingo's farm. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Taigen, and thank you, everyone, for being here to listen and engage. We will hopefully have time to really discuss, you know, what after I've talked a little bit. But I did want to talk about my experience of attending the January intensive at Green Gulch Farm in Northern California for 3 weeks this past January. And this is Green Gulch Farm is a combination monastery and operating organic farm, for those who are not familiar with it. But every year, so they hold different programs and sesshins, and every January they do this 3 week intensive practice, not practice period, but it's a period of practice, and it is intense. And as far as I know, this has been going on for a number of years, maybe 20 years, maybe more. Typically led by the senior abbot, Tenshin Reb Anderson, and every year has its own topic. And I was really intrigued by the topic for this year, which was entitled The Pivotal Function of Zazen, Face-to-Face Transmission. So, you know, for the months leading up to my going there, I was sort of really curious about, what is that? This sounds like, you know, really we're going to get like the real thing this year. And not that we haven't in past years. I will say that this is my third time of doing this intensive. And every year is different. And every year has, you know, its own topic. I don't remember the other ones, but I'll summarize, maybe overly summarize, but for the purpose of this talk, I kind of have to. What this was about is Zazen, basically, and Zazen in the sense of being the business of Buddhas, which is actively pivoting. Buddhas are continuously pivoting between, meeting themselves in Zazen and then pivoting to meet all beings and meeting all beings in wherever beings are, you know, wherever someone else is at. One of the quotes that I wrote down from Reb was, "The great way of all Buddhas is nothing other than giving a face and receiving a face." So what that means is really person to person. You know, that's how Buddha activity takes place, is person to person. I think it might also include, you know, person to animals or person to themselves. But practicing this involves being still and accepting and remembering stillness. And that was my touch phrase for the whole 3 weeks and beyond, because it continues to be my touch phrase, is remembering stillness. Those two words really encompassed pretty much the whole experience for me. And I'm going to tell you more about that over the course of my talk. But I will say, and I will say it again, that everything in the intensive is designed to help facilitate this, to facilitate this remembering stillness. And I'll tell you a little bit about the circumstances that contribute to helping to remember stillness. We had, as I mentioned, it's a combination monastery and fully functioning organic farm, and we had about, I think, 85 people, roughly, at this intensive period of practice. About a dozen were working in the kitchen full-time. Some were working on the farm full-time. And I would say there were roughly between 60 and 75 people in the Zendo at all times. So the Zendo is quite large, but they also had to have, you know, kind of rows down the middle for, you know, they're really at capacity. The daily schedule for pretty much every day except for rest days is that it starts with the wake-up bell at 4:25 a.m., and somebody comes around from building to building, and they are ringing a bell, and they will, you know, wake you up. It ends at 9 p.m. with everyone coming together in the Zendo and chanting the refuges and then going to sleep. 4:25 a.m. sounds really challenging, but if you just stay on your Chicago Central Time schedule, it's really 6:25 a.m. So that... That's actually quite doable for me. I know that's not true for everyone, but you're always a little bit sleep deprived, and you can catch up a little bit, you know, during nap if you take a nap on the breaks during the day, or. But it's pretty rigorous. So it leaves you feeling a little bit, you know, it's a little bit challenging. It pushes your envelope a little bit. The mornings for pretty much every day consisted of multiple periods of zazen. Sometimes there was a seminar in which Reb would talk about more about, you know, the pivotal activity of Buddhas or remembering stillness or, you know, something that would give us something to chew on for a little while. Afternoons typically consisted of a work period for a few hours and then a break for a couple hours, and then the evenings were more zazen or sometimes silent study and then some zazen and then, you know, the refuges and going to sleep. Nearly all day, at almost every day, is silent. Entirely silent, really no talking. Maybe you can whisper if you need to sort of mention something to someone, except for after work period through dinner. So, you know, this really helps. I think it's a huge support. When I tell this to friends, you know, who don't practice, you know, that I'm going on this retreat and here's the silent schedule, they're all like, how can you possibly do that? But it really helps to develop and maintain that still zazen mind. And you don't really notice that happening. It's just that you keep getting sort of immersed into it. But it also helps you bring that zazen mind into your activity. So when you're, you know, on your work period, it gives you still some support for your zazen mind. And it's balanced with, you know, some time to converse with other people at dinner. Some people find that to be a huge relief that they finally can talk. I actually always find it to be a little bit jarring because for me it's much easier to be silent and just sort of be with my own thoughts. And to me it can feel a little bit like, oh my God, now I have to talk to these people. But I also, you know, but I also really want to meet people from other sanghas, and it's amazing to me every single time this has happened, and it never seems like it will, but by the end of the 3 weeks, I've had some kind of contact with every person there. I know everybody's name. You know, I know something about pretty much everyone. And it just all happens gradually. So a lot of what is happening is just settling into the schedule, settling into the routine, settling into turning inward and facing outward, and you know, and that's pretty natural. I will say that for me, a large part of what stands out about the experience is that you let go of, I have to let go of most of my personal preferences in order to do this. You know, you're not really well, there's no cell phone service. So you are not calling people or checking your phone all the time. They ask you not to bring computers. There's some minimal use of email and Wi-Fi. And over the you know, times that I've been there, I've learned a little bit about the things that I just really need as my holdouts, which are coffee, chocolate in the form of mini Hershey bars, my electric toothbrush, and the New York Times mini crossword puzzle, which I do every morning on my phone and which I did every single morning on the intensive because that just helps me wake up. And so, you know, I think I found it much easier this time to balance between gratification and renunciation. You know, I was able to kind of keep to the schedule, for the most part, adhere to the practice as it's presented to you, other than, you know, my little holdouts, which I know what they are. But I know on the previous two times, I would either try to hold on too tightly or too loosely. And both of those present really, you know, a lot of challenges. If you hold on to the schedule and the sort of frame too tightly, you just start to feel bad, and you get. I got sick the first year, which might have had something to do with that. If you hold on too loosely, you don't really feel that. I don't really feel that I'm engaging with it. So, you know, this. I felt like I was able to balance well between holding on and letting go of the frame. I had kind of decided, as the time unfolded, that I was really going to keep to the schedule and not, you know, not take breaks for myself or, you know, other things. I think the previous time I went running every other day, and this time I brought my running shoes and everything, and this time I was like, oh, there's just no way. I'm just going to lie down. That's all I want to do during our rest periods. And so that was what worked this time. I think I mentioned that there's a work period, and everyone has a job for work period. The first year, I cleaned toilets in the women's restrooms every day because I was on the work crew, and there were only a couple women on the work crew, and we got the women's restrooms. The second year, I worked in the kitchen chopping vegetables every day, which was also a really good discipline. This year, I happened to get the wonderful job of being the Eno's assistant. And I think I got that job because the current Eno there is Hakusho, who was our Branching Streams residential priest here in 2016, who came and practiced with us for 6 months. And we, those of us who were here at that time, you know, developed a warm relationship with Hakusho, and we know him, he knows us, and I think that's a large part of how I was able to get this wonderful job, which involved really helping the Eno to take care of the temple, take care of the Zendo in particular, and all of the functions that are involved with that. So for most of the time every day, I would be with my sort of work crew from the Soji crew people cleaning and maintaining the Zendo. So we were brushing cushions and dusting all of the statues and figures on the altar and around the Zendo, and doing, you know, Zendo laundry for, like, you know, floor towels and dusters and things like that. I mended support cushions and restuffed zafus, and was making altar cards for, you know, the way that we put a card on the altar when someone has passed away. They do the same thing, only they do calligraphy, and you have to, like, practice. I had a little, you know, alphabet in front of me, and I had to sort of follow along and use a calligraphy pen, and that was a little intimidating, but also very fun, because I used to be a graphic designer, and so that was a fun way to, you know, kind of get back to that. I sewed setsu tips for their Orioki sets that they sell to people. And the setsu is the, we use a spatula here, but a setsu is it's a long stick with a cloth tip on the end that you use for cleaning bowls. And I had to sew a bunch of those and then instruct other people who had purchased Oryoki sets how to re-sew their setsu tips. And also trained new servers. So there was a balance between working with other people and working with things. And it was just so nice. And what part of what was nice in particular was to see all the ways in which their practice is very similar to ours. You know, it's maybe a little more intense, and it's maybe a little bit more, you know, all day. But a lot of the dimensions are the same. The service in the morning is longer, but they do the same forms, the same prostrations at the same times, and you know, many of the same chants. And it's just we do things very much the same, and that is nice to know. It takes some of the mystery away from it. But I will say again that everything there is designed to help facilitate letting go and returning to stillness. So the whole environment of being in a monastery is, you know, really designed, I think, to help us to engage in practice. I mentioned, you know, no computers. You follow the schedule while also finding ways to take care of yourself, taking showers when you need to during breaks, or taking walks. Maintaining silence, talking when it's appropriate or talking when it's necessary. I will say that everyone that I encountered there had a really nice just style of offering feedback and offering correction in a way that we don't always get in our lives. And I imagine they don't always get that in their lives either, but everyone that I encountered was invariably just so helpful about finding a tactful and diplomatic way to point out something that I had done wrong, because I did a lot of things wrong, you know? And people could bring it to my attention in a way that didn't make me feel, you know, ashamed or upset. I could just be like, oh, yeah, okay, well, and then they'd give me sort of, you know, an idea of what I could do differently, and that's really helpful. Your mind stops, you know, kind of clenching up every time you do something, because you can feel like, okay, people are going to help me do this. They're not really so much doing this in a way of criticizing me. They're helping me, and I can accept that. So there are also, you know, beautiful natural settings for contemplative walks or hikes, and there's, you know, ample opportunity to study the self. So I this came to mind for me in particular around the use of my personal time when I get, you know, songs stuck in my head and then I want to listen to them. And so, you know, sometimes I would just, you know, listen to music on my iTunes. But other times I would feel like, you know, part of me wanted to listen to something, and other times I was like, you know, that just feels like too much. Or I'd turn it on and it would be like, this is just too much. I just need to like be in silence right now. And that was really different. I wanted to say a little bit about back pain, because, you know, we're doing like 10 to 12 periods of zazen a day, and many of you have heard me complain, you know, vociferously and bitterly about my back pain. And I had discovered just before leaving for this experience how to relax into my back pain. I finally figured out, after studying this for like, I don't know, 7 or 8 years, that what I was actually doing was trying too hard to sit up too straight, and that was what was causing my back pain, and I was able to just, you know, kind of let that go a little bit and relax. And it really helped to sit with minimal pain for the whole experience. I won't say that Well, what I noticed over time was that after a couple of weeks, my back muscles were just sore. And it was just, like, I could feel like, okay, I'm just sore now. I'm just, they're tired. It's okay. But even that, just learning to relax in lots of different ways was certainly a part of this experience for me. Which brings me to the theme, again, of remembering stillness. I've been thinking about what I wanted to say for this talk all week, but today I really, this morning, sort of sat down and tried to organize my thoughts, and I happened to see on Facebook a post from Lion's Roar, the topic of which was, is enlightenment off limits to lay people? And I realized as I was reading this that this is what I want to talk about with respect to this intensive. Because what I want to talk about is ways in which our practice here at Ancient Dragon or at any, you know, kind of non-residential lay person's temple out in the world is similar to this experience and ways in which it's different. So I'm going to read you the question from this post. And the question is, I recently attended a Dharma talk in which the teacher said that lay people, even if they practice sincerely, just don't have the proper causes and conditions for full enlightenment. I feel that I need to know if this is true or not. What possibilities does this practice hold for me as a lay person, and what is beyond my reach? And I have this question all the time. I think I have for a long time felt like, those people at, you know, different monasteries, they're doing it right, and we're just doing, you know, some pale version. So I've really struggled with this question, and I don't have the answer. Okay, so you know, part of the column is they have three Dharma teachers from different lineages offer their response, and their responses were great. If anybody gets a chance to read this, they were wonderful. But I can also, like, I realize that by virtue of participating in all of the practice activities that we have, I do have my own opinion, because I feel like this question relates directly to my experience with the intensive and with my experience here. So I'll come back to the intensive for a moment, and just, I will say it again, everything in this experience is designed to support you in the practice of remembering stillness. It can't be said enough times, but, you know, while I was there, because I kind of checked in with myself periodically, I didn't necessarily feel this happening. I didn't really necessarily feel anything special at all. The same things were going through my head during Zazen, or, you know, popping into my head that normally do. You know, always this feeling of, you know, I'm not doing this right. I'm not paying attention enough. I'm not, you know, whatever. And so it's not like I became some different person, but I was able to notice when I was fighting the constraints there and when I was not fighting them. I noticed when grasping and craving was really intense for me and when it was not so present. I think I'll mention that every 5 days is a rest day and you get a day off, which means that you only have to get up for, like, I don't know, 6:30 Zazen or something. And you get most of the day to do whatever you want, and then at dinner, they make a wonderful dessert. And, you're kind of been dealing with, like, the austerity and just, you know, invariably for me, it always feels like, okay, I just got to where I could deal with this, and now they're giving me dessert again, and so here comes all my grasping and craving all over again, and you know, and there it is, and then you get to, like, deal with it all over again. You don't really feel these things so much at the time. What I really noticed was when I returned to daily life, you know, even from, like, getting to the airport on my way home, and you know, the getting home, the first few days of work, just feeling like, wow, you know, my brain is just not functioning the way that it normally does. And after a few days, that experience faded. And I, whether it was being more in touch with stillness or not, something really changed. And I can see now that I'm much more caught up in the daily distractions again. The distractions that characterize all of our daily lives, and that seem maybe to be, you know, in opposition to practice or the purpose of practice. And I think that, you know, I think that's the seem to is really important that way. You know, I can't really know how much moment to moment awareness of stillness, you know, remains for me from this experience. I can sometimes catch it for a moment in zazen or in something else, but then, you know, 2 seconds later, I'm like, oh yeah, right, okay, it's gone. But one thing that I do know from this intensive period of practice is that it's always right here. You know, stillness is always right here. And in my distraction right now, you know, even giving this talk, it's very hard to remember stillness while I'm also trying to remember what I want to say. But I know that stillness is right here all the time, and that, you know, in any moment there is that possibility of finding stillness, and that's true for all of us. And it doesn't, you don't have to, you know, go away for years, and you don't have to, there's a lot of things you don't have to do, but you do have to find ways to help you engage with that stillness so that you know what it feels like and so that you can find it a little bit more easily. So the last day of the intensive, I will say that the experience, in case it didn't sound challenging enough already, it ends with a 5-day session where you're really in the zendo all day. There's no work period. There's no 2-hour break at the, you know, in the afternoon. You're really in the zendo. And so the very last day in the morning, I'm doing walking meditation, and I'm walking, and you know, the zendo doors are open, and it's warmed up a little bit, and there's this beautiful warm sunlight coming in on me, and I'm just, you know, this is so great. Here I am in stillness, you know, yay me. And suddenly I had this sudden thought about what it would be like to be at work again in 2 days. You know, 2 days from now I'm going to be like sitting, you know, behind my desk. And, you know, what will that be like? And it happened that there was a Q&A period coming up where people could go up and, you know, publicly ask Reb a question in front of the assembly. And so I decided, you know, I'm going to ask a question about this. And my question was basically, you know, how to remember stillness in the tension and anxiety and stress-filled situations of daily life. The example I happened to use was a particularly provocative situation from my daily life. But we all have very provocative, stress-filled situations in our daily life. And so the details of my example are not so important. But I asked, and Reb answered in front of everybody, and we had a very brief dialogue around this. And I, you know, I appreciated his answer, but his answer didn't really matter so much to me. What was important to me was to ask the question and to give and receive a face around this. You know, going back to the face-to-face transmission, it was very important to me in that moment that he and everybody else see me and see, you know, my life, and that I see him, and that we engage around this way that the Dharma could manifest in my life, in my particulars. And, you know, what I realized is that just asking that question of how can I remember stillness in these situations that make it hard to remember stillness actually is remembering stillness. And engaging with it is the pivotal function of all Buddhas. You know, we each have our own unique face, and we need to be able to bring that to our unique situations and to bring stillness to those situations. So my opinion on, you know, the question that, not my question, but the question that I was just reading, the lengthy question I was reading you before, my opinion is that, you know, it is wonderful to have the good fortune to be able to engage in an intensive period of practice for a period of time. And I think actually, I think it's essential to be able to do this for a period of time. That period of time doesn't have to be a few years. It doesn't have to be a few weeks. It can be, you know, coming to an all-day sitting if you can. It can be daily zazen practice. It can be, you know, coming to a three-day sesshin. It can be whatever, finding whatever, whatever circumstances in your life help to support some intensive practice. And what is essential about it is getting the opportunity to find and engage with stillness in your life. I think it's really, really helpful to be in conditions that support this. You know, so we have our Sangha here. We have other places that we can go for a period of time. Not everybody has that, though. So, you know, I think it's really important for people to be able to work with whatever conditions in your life help to support this. Some people... So it's important to find these conditions, but I want to say that I think it's equally important to then engage with the world and meet others with the stillness that you have. And perhaps you will find even more stillness by engaging with that question of how can I remember stillness while I'm engaging in these situations? Because it is always here, you know, with us. It's a matter of how do I find it in this moment? So, you know, some people engage in this process by working to maintain a monastery, which is wonderful because then, you know, others of us have these places that we can go to practice. But some people do it just by meeting other people in the ordinary world and helping them with their problems, helping them solve whatever problems are in your particular realm to help solve. Some people do this by driving people where they want to go. Some people do it by cleaning up after them. But you know, all of these are worthwhile activities. None are you know, better or more Buddhist or holier than others. You know, they're all good vehicles for helping ourselves and helping others to awaken. So, I don't know if it was a quote or a paraphrase that I wrote down in my copious notes from this experience, but one of the things Reb said was, you know, Buddhas are looking after everybody and taking care of them. And when we do this, we are engaging in Buddha's activity. So I think the last thing I want to say is to just, you know, offer encouragement to find activities that support this in your life. And if you can make it to, you know, here or someplace else for an intensive period of practice, maybe you will find that to be a support. I guess I did. So that's what I have to say. And maybe I'm hoping that we could have a little discussion or any questions anybody wants to know about, you know, what this experience was like for me or just the details of how you might do that. Whoops, the floor is open. No, I've had that thought. Many people there had that thought. I don't know. I don't pretend to know why any one thing is the way it is, but I will say that for me, I understand it as another aspect of letting go of my personal preferences. I don't get to feel, you know, and I always feel a little bit off balance. You could liken it to a hostage situation, but I won't. But I don't know if there is a particular purpose in this, the lack of sleep in the schedule per se. I know you do appreciate it more and notice it more when you are able to sleep in on rest days. Does anybody? I know other people here have gone to this experience. Anybody else have a thought about that? Paula.
Since I'm a very active person, I didn't feel sleep. So I actually was here than scheduled.
Wow.
And I felt that because we were practicing in stillness, it was actually resting for me. So I had a different perspective.
Huh. Okay. You didn't feel like you needed more sleep? Wow. Okay. So maybe we're not all exactly wired the same.
But I did feel the schedule always feels, even if I stay at the centers as just a resident, like without participating in an intensive.
Yeah.
I always feel constrained by the schedule.
Yeah.
So that's my thing. Like, I love my freedom to go wherever I want, whenever I want to. And I always feel a little bit depressed in the middle of it because I feel like I'm locked in.
Yeah.
Even though
yeah.
I can leave it anytime.
Yeah. I felt that way too. Not always about sleep, but about like the bell rings and you have to go to Zazen. Even though you're in the middle of like reading something or thinking something or, you know, walking somewhere and that's hard. It's for me, that is a big piece of letting go of my personal preferences, and it does lead to exactly that feeling partway through of like, this is hard. But I don't know that the feeling ever gets any easier, but you do kind of move through it, you know, to where it doesn't, the circumstances haven't changed, but you're not fighting it quite so much. So I don't know if it's maybe also about the fight. I think maybe each, you know, everybody there is so different that I think everybody's experience of that fact is totally different, but also, you know, totally relevant to their own practice. Yes?
I think it is different at different times, but traditionally, being sleep-deprived is part of it, and it helps to weaken resistance of it, because the schedule itself is one of the main teachers. And this is true in all monastic traditions. It's true in Catholic monastic tradition too, talking to monastics, across traditions to monastics, just following the schedule, whatever is happening, just doing the next step completely, is itself a tremendous teacher. So we all have our own personal preferences, and if we feel like we can do whatever we want, then, you know, we go this way and that, but just to follow the schedule mm-hmm. Can be a wonderful practice. Really helpful. But when I was at Tassajara in my early 30s, I also didn't feel too bad, and I would stay up later and get up earlier and read whatever. So it's different at different times for different people. But just to follow the schedule and to do the next thing, the bell rings and you just do it, does something physically.
I will add to that and say that I am not somebody who always really gravitated toward this practice. I wanted to practice, but I happened to write a little essay about my very first sesshin about a month before I went to this intensive. And what I remembered from that was how much I hated it. Really, like the first day I went to an all-day sitting, it was so horrible every minute. I just, you know, kind of relived that. And for me, that's the resistance and the fighting. And I didn't understand at that time how to work with it, or that it was possible to work with it, or that working with it might bring me a little bit of relief. And so I'm not as in touch with you know, how hard this is, except for, you know, when you really kind of turn up the fire on it, and it gets really intense.
One way I think about the hardness of it, the difficulty of it, is that it's going to be really good training when really hard things happen in our life. I mean, right now I'm dealing with a couple of very sick people who cannot take a break from their pain.
Yeah.
They can't, it won't go away, so they have to deal with it, and it gives us the ability to cope.
Yeah,
It's almost like a skill. It's practice in mm-hmm. a very literal sense of it. And I just think that's so valuable.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you don't know when you're going to be faced with something really hard. And sometimes it's temporary, like a broken leg, or sometimes it's never going to get better. Mm-hmm. It's like a way to deal with it in your mind and your body.
Yeah. I agree, and I've been really realizing lately that even when at times my own personal situation eases up, there are many people in that very moment who are experiencing all that pain, and how can I bring that feeling of, you know, relief from pain to that person if I can? There's suffering going on constantly, whether it's my own or someone else's. And sometimes just being in touch with my own helps me feel like it's easier to be in touch with someone else's.
Yeah,
it
helps with compassion.
Yeah.
I was struck by your comment around about participation and asking questions. And I've been thinking about how, like, participation for me is really central to my practice in a way, because I have this strong need to participate, and also a lot of fear around participation. So whenever I participate, like now, or ask a question, or whatever, it's something that I reflect about, and often there's a lot of self-judgment around it. Sometimes it's like, oh, yeah, that's pretty good. There's always this sort of deconstruction of my ego and how it relates to my heart's desire to, you know, share.
Yeah. I think I can relate to that. That there's the self involved. You know, did I do this well or not? Or kind of self-critique. But then there is this wish to be a part of something and share and give and take. I think that is, you know, giving and receiving a face. That no one can know you if you don't give a face, you know, and you can't know others if you don't receive it. And we can have a lot of judgment arise around that experience. You know, did I do okay? Was this right? And the judgment, you know, maybe we can work with it and break it down a little bit over time, too. Howard,
this kind of back to the schedule thing, but also about judgment, because the interesting thing about the schedule is that people, when you're in those kinds, I haven't done a green culture Tassajara, but I've done other longer retreats, but it's always interesting because the schedule is not just a schedule, it's somebody put it together and other people are doing the schedule with you. So, like, it's always funny how much when I would have to wake up at, you know, 4:30 a.m., I don't want to wake up at this time. I don't want to wake up at this time. And, you know, I really don't like the guy who's ringing the bell right now. And I spend, like, the first zazen, you know, like, session just being like, I really don't like that guy. And realizing that, like, I have no reason not to like this guy. This is part of the schedule. This is his job. He probably doesn't want to be up either. He or she doesn't want to be up. And then I start doing things like, you know, versions of, like, justifying things or justifying my resentment or something like that. And it's just interesting watching how much, like, my likes or dislikes are always there and how much I will judge people for it in and out of this schedule that all of us are sort of confined within our working out together. It's like looking at, you know, every situation that happens inside that schedule as like a koan with a cast of characters that I don't really necessarily know much about, but I have to know more about, and that I'm sort of imposing a lot of my own likes and dislikes about these cast of characters. Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much it. I don't know what to say about that. That's pretty much how I felt. But you know, it's worth going through, you know, for sure. And I've gone through it every single time, so it's not like it goes away. It just, you know, maybe
it's a different belt.
Yeah, right. Well, somebody used a metaphor for me one time of something like a record player, which is still in hopefully everybody's consciousness, even though we don't use records so much anymore. But like on a record player, you know, you're going around the same spot again and again, and the same spot keeps coming around the record. But every time it comes around, it's a little bit different. You know, you're going a little bit deeper in, and so I think that's kind of what practice is, that same thing coming around again, and, you know, how am I going to respond to it this time? I saw that you had your hand up. I don't know your name.
Sohaila.
Hi, Sohaila.
When you say face-to-face and you want to get to know during the day,
yeah.
Is it like on a physical level?
You mean physical, like an actual physical face to face?
Like a person, body, or just it's a different level of face to face?
Did you hear the question?
Okay. I think what you were saying is when I say face to face, what do I mean? Do I mean like, you know, sort of on a physical level, like you get to know this person, what, you know, I don't know if you mean what they look like, what their dimensions are, or as a person.
Why it is important.
So if it is getting to know two people coming together, what is important about that? Is that an okay paraphrase?
Yeah. The first question is yes. Why? I mean, what level?
Uh-huh.
And if it is in physical level.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, this is an interesting question because I know that some people who are listening to this talk are going to be listening to it through this thing, and they're not going to see me or you or any of us. And they're still going to get a little bit of face-to-face, but not the way that we do when we are really face-to-face. What I think is important about face-to-face, and this, again, is just my opinion, is that we see each other. One thing that's important is that we see each other. There are words, but there are a whole lot of nonverbal ways of communicating that we have when we see each other. You know, I raise my eyebrow or you raise your eyebrow, and it adds a dimension of meaning that words don't convey. And we talk about, you know, Zen teachings as being beyond words and letters. So we have language, but our language is really limited in conveying a lot of things and a lot of meaning. And being able to, you know, meet face-to-face, we get the nonverbals. Another thing about meeting face-to-face is that we can continue to, Dogen talks about the Dharma really emerging in the interaction between a Buddha and a Buddha. That there's no real enlightenment contained just in one person. That enlightenment really happens in the activity or dialogue between beings, that we are bringing something forth together. And that's why it's important. That's why practicing all together is important. That's another maybe aspect of face-to-face, is that we're all here and we're all supporting each other. And we come to know each other by being all together. I don't know all the details of what's in anybody's mind or heart here, and I don't know all the details of, the difficult situations that everybody goes through in their life. But we come to know each other a little bit, and we continue to come to know each other over time. And we influence each other. We're all kind of also, at the same time as coming to know each other, we're all kind of mutually influencing each other too, and ideally, helping each other to understand things. I kind of give my talk, but then when everybody asks me questions, that really helps me to have to dig for an answer that I wouldn't have if you hadn't posed that particular question. So things, we're constantly developing our understanding by talking back and forth. So I think that is at least part of face to face. Does that answer the question that you had, or is there more to it? Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So you want to add something?
No, I think okay. That's good. How do we meet each other fully? And there's no end to that.
Yeah.
But we will end the talk.